This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycast.
You're on Joy 94.9. Thank you for listening in. You're on Escape Hour with Stefan and Mark. We have a guest this week who's going to be talking to us about a few different things. Luke is originally from the UK. You're not from the UK?
No, I'm up near Byron Bay.
But didn't you move to Byron Bay when you were 12?
Yeah, that's from
the...
No, not from the UK. No, I'm Australian.
Oh, right. So then you lived in...
I did, yes.
..the UK thereafter.
Yeah,
then you came back. Oh, okay.
That's
right.
Yeah, that's fine.
That wasn't on LinkedIn.
That's fine.
Your pre-12-year-old life.
I'll let you have it. The accent's there, so... Okay.
That's all right. It's no judgment zone. welcome to Joy 94.9 today.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Escape Hour. What we were talking about off-air is language.
Yes.
And being a chef. Now, you've worked in the UK. You've worked with very big chefs. You're currently working in Melbourne. You've worked in Byron Bay. We're going to really talk a lot about Byron Bay and what there is to do. But we were talking just before the show about being a chef and how you have to be a bit of a wordsmith as well as a meatsmith and bloody blah, all these other things you have to do. How do you phrase a menu to make it really appealing in a way that's going to satisfy not only your need to communicate what's coming out of the kitchen so that it lands on the table accurately and the guest experience of trying to read through it and piece it all together? How does that work? That's fascinating.
It's a really tricky kind of predicament to have. I mean, you have the kind of the more higher-end fine dining restaurants, you can get away with, just listing your ingredients, having the guests come in for an experience and really trust what you're going to put in front of them. And they're there to enjoy, for the chef and for the service, and to enjoy what's happening, whether it be lunch, dinner, breakfast. As you look at more casual establishments or, your everyday sort of meals, you really have to try and communicate in a way that people can understand what you're trying to say and what you're trying to serve them. It is really tricky. Sometimes you get it right and sometimes you get it wrong. But basically, you want to give people the relevant information without boring them, because I'm sure you've had it yourself. There's nothing worse than when you go to a place and you spend 10 minutes reading a menu and you feel like you've forgotten what was at the top of the menu before you finish it. So
I'd just end up ordering the chicken in that case.
Exactly. So you really don't want to bore people, with kind of giving a description on everything. But at the same time, you don't want them to be scared of your menu as well. You really want them to be able to engage in it and have the fluency there. So for me, it's been a big learning experience over the years to kind of make it approachable for people. Everything to do with a restaurant has to be approachable. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, people get intimidated. They don't relate to what you're trying to do, and they quite simply won't come back.
Joy 94.9, Australia's best radio station.
You're with Joy 94.9 with Stefan, who is absolutely doing a bang-up job on the panel. Stefan's recently graduated from the Taste of Radio course, and we really do encourage people to look at ways that they can contribute to Joy. 50% of our listeners... hundreds of millions of listeners are not from the LGBTI community. They're from the straight community, and we love that. We've got so many allies. We are here to be the voice of the diverse gay and lesbian, intersex, bisexual, trans community, and we want your voices. We are here for your voices. And for you to participate, you can become a member, you can volunteer, you can do many things. Stefan, you just did the Taste of Radio course.
Yes.
Now you're on air.
And yes, absolutely, and it was a really good experience learning about how it happens and what to do and how to prepare, how to interview guests. It's really good. I would really recommend doing that course, and if you're a member, there's a little discount as well in the course fee.
Yep.
So it's a good way to give back to
so you've been a member for 5 years.
I've been a member for 5 years, and I decided a few months ago that I wanted to go a little bit further and was interested in doing the course. Never signed up. I've been interested for a couple of years now. I never really signed up for it, and then one day I just decided, yes, I'll do it. And it was really good. Got to meet lot of nice people that were doing the course as well. And I've been on...
And now you're part of our team?
And I'm now part of the team, which is great. Yeah.
Fantastic. And there's lots of other ways to volunteer at Joy. You don't have to go on air, because that's not for everybody. Mm. There's a lot of other things you can do, fundraising, working in admin, reception duties. There's always probably some envelopes to stuff, that kind of work as well. Mm. So... do not hesitate to be a part of Joy. We've got 300 volunteers. It takes us all. We need money. So don't hesitate to give us your money. And because I think it's about $115 an hour to keep us on air.
Well, I think hearing this morning, it's around $1 million a year to keep us on air. So, yes. Yep. Membership is really important. It's donations really important. Are really important. They are tax deductible from $2.
Yep. Just go to joy.org.au and we'll take your money.
Absolutely.
And thank you for that. Today, our guest, Luke Hidden, is a young chef. You've got a very impressive CV. You've worked internationally and you've worked for some very impressive organisations. So talk to us about those kinds of organisations you've worked in and what kind of pressure that puts on you as a young chef, because chefing is not an easy... It's not for everybody.
No, that's absolutely correct there. You know, it's not for everyone. I mean, as an individual... You know, I strive under those sort of conditions. I do love kind of the pressure environment of it. You know, whether that's just because it's kind of the only career I've done and what I felt like I was probably always going to do, or it's something you kind of learn to adapt to. I'm not sure. But, yeah, I mean, working in, you know, the top-end restaurants and some of the best in the world, I mean, it's an amazing experience, but it does bring that pressure. You have to commit your life to what you're doing, and when you're working at those places, it is your life.
So where was the first highbrow or very high reputed establishment you worked? Was it in Byron Bay or
No, it was probably I did all my training in Byron. You know, I worked at some cafes up there, a couple of sort of smart sort of restaurants, but probably wasn't until I came to Melbourne and spent a little bit of time down here, not too long, but just worked at a couple of sort of, you know, bordering on fine dining restaurants.
Right.
And just got a bit of a feel for it and started to actually realise that, you know, the little bit more time taken and the care for the ingredients, you know, that's what really kind of made me excited to get up and come to work. And, you know, it kind of led me to be like, if I really want to do this seriously and I really want to kind of make this into something that, you know, is going to, you know, give me something back one day, then I probably do need to get out there and experience the world. And the UK just seemed like a really, you know, great place to start.
Yeah, a lot of Australians make that kangaroo hop over to the UK to work in fine dining.
Right, yeah.
So a lot of chefs, the people that I know, own restaurants that I've spoken to, really happy with the Australian talent that comes because they're good workers.
Yes.
So talk about that experience. How did you get it all happening? Because
it was a funny story for me. It was actually more of a, you know, obviously it was something that I always wanted to do and I'd spoken about quite a lot, but... It ended up being in about 4 months that I went from working quite happily, having a nice place in Melbourne, to being, you know, getting on a plane and going to London. It was kind of, you know, a decision I made. Me and my girlfriend at the time decided, you know, it's something we really want to get out there and do. And I felt like I was getting a touch stale. You know, I just had that, you know, being early 20s, had that real hunger to kind of learn more and more. And it just felt like something that was really natural to do. I literally kind of took a bit of a leap of faith, really, and just kind of went for it and thought, once I was there, then I can kind of get stuck in and you know, go from that.
And you went to one of the biggest names in town.
I did. I built up to that, yes. It did take me a little while over there to find my feet. But I was really lucky. I was really fortunate to work with some great chefs along the way. You know, started kind of one star level, then went to two star, and then all the way up to three Michelin star level.
So Fat Duck.
Yes, yes.
So it's famous.
Yes.
So that helps people understand the level of pressure you work on. What did you learn there? What was the top things that you learned? Because that would be not only a kitchen that is high pressure, the standards must be consistently top,
exactly,
top, but innovative too. I mean, he's, you know, using weird stuff to make.
I mean, the Fat Duck,
weird things.
You know, it'll always have a very special place for me because it's an amazing restaurant, not just for what it produces for the guests that come in the door. It really gives back to people that work there as well.
How so?
Because, you know, the way you're treated and the systems that have been set up, you know, by, you know, Heston and his close-knit team, it really is to get the best out of the people that work for him and to try and keep them there for a sustained period of time. Because
right.
With any business, if you have the consistent team and you have the consistency, then, you know, you're going to achieve great things. So the support network was there for us. You know, the hours still long, but managed compared to other restaurants. You know, we got the opportunity to, you know, work with the best equipment, the best ingredients, the best suppliers in the, you know, in the whole of the UK
and Europe. Snail ice cream.
Snail porridge, actually, yeah. But, yeah, we did make some bizarre things, you know. And it is funny when you look back, you know, obviously it's been a couple of years since I've been gone from there now, but you look back and, you know, it is quite bizarre what becomes everyday life, you know, in a place like that. You know, you walk in and, you know, you'll have, you know, 25 kilos of black truffles to put away in the morning, you know.
It's actually worth a fortune.
Oh, yeah.
So stock control.
Yeah, you're talking, but, I mean, because it is what it is, the enormity of the restaurant and how amazing it is, you know, that's your everyday life. You're dealing mm-hmm. with great stuff like that all the time. And, you know, some of the equipment that's worth £80,000 even, you know. And
so, hold on. What in a kitchen can be worth £80,000?
Well, we actually had a...
Heston's wallet?
Probably a little bit more than that. No, we had a machine that... it was a form of... basically, it evaporated liquid... water from a liquid... without cooking it. So it's used in hospitals for blood. And yeah, it's called the rocket machine. So that was... it was well over £50,000 anyway, that thing. Mm. So
it's a lot of money for a kitchen gadget.
But yeah, I mean, there was no end. The amazing thing. And you learn to question every part of your cooking, you know, from, you know, are we doing this the correct way? Is there a way we can be, you know, treat the product better, you know, store it better? You don't just become a cook there. You know, I feel like that's probably what the Fat Dog did for me. It kind of really rounded me off in the way I work, the way I present myself, the way I, you know, keep a kitchen, keep produce, you know, treat the people you work with. You know, that's what it does. It really rounds you off as an individual.
So I think with the modern celebrity food culture, we have a lot of people associate kitchens purely being a Gordon Ramsay abuse fest.
Yeah.
Is that a anomaly, or do you see that level of pressure from Byron Bay to London to Melbourne, is that a bit overstated? Because we're going to be doing a lot of overstated things throughout this program.
I mean, no, it's worth addressing. I mean, it's not overstated, because I've worked in several kitchens where, you know, you wake up every day and you feel sick about going to work, you know, because it is a pressure environment and
it's a kitchen full of tears.
It's an aggressive environment. Mm. But in saying that, you know, the culture is changing. It is slow. The old dinosaurs, where that kind of, you know, that attitude comes from, are slowly fading. But it has to change. Otherwise, we're not going to have a fine dining industry in the next 15 years. You know, people are not going to do it. Even we see now, there's not the same amount of young kids that want to be chefs and want to put in the hours. Everyone's concerned about, you know, what they're doing and how much, you know, how far they can advance. And you know, being a chef is hard. You have to put in a lot of hours. And, you know, you start at the bottom and you have to work your way through. That's, you know, that's the way the ladder is.
Well, chef means boss, doesn't it, at the end of the day?
Exactly. You know, and if you don't know how to wash the dishes properly, or you don't know how to peel the vegetables properly at the bottom first, then you can never run a kitchen, in my mind. You know, that's my opinion, of course. But
That truism that came through from the... there was a woman who did the cooking show, the American woman who went to France, and she just practiced cutting onions, and that's all she did.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so there's a truism there.
Exactly. No, there is.
Get the basics right.
Exactly. I mean, the fundamentals of cooking are so important. I mean, it's great. You know, you see all the celebrity, you know, saga around cooking at the moment, and that's great. It's been great for the industry because it's brought it into people's homes. So, you know, people can see food, whether it be fine dining, whether it be something they can do in 15 minutes, it's on every network all the time. And so it's great for us because people see it. On the other hand, there is still the hard work side to it that people probably don't understand. You know, you have a lot
and
of...
And then there's wearing Crocs.
Yeah.
Sorry to ruin that.
Yeah, you got me. But, yeah, I mean, when you're standing up for 12 hours a day, you want to be pretty comfy.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw a hybrid version called Birkin Crocs the other day.
Oh, wow.
That were styled like Birkin.
Leather?
No, they were styled like Birkenstock clogs, but they were painted green and had the holes in them like Crocs. And that's enough. I think I've ruined enough people's Saturday afternoon. Okay, so there is a lot of stress. But what did you bring from your Byron Bay experience to London?
Basically,
being a bit chilled out about things.
Yeah, well, I tried. Didn't last so long.
Right.
No, but obviously, it was great to, you know, you work in an area like Byron and you have, you know, great produce available to you. And I always look back on that really fondly, as it's an area that's an abundance of beautiful soil and we grow amazing things, you know. So I was from an early age, I got to use great ingredients. And that science throughout my whole career, you know, right up to the top end, you know, is always stuck really closely with me, is using the best thing available to you.
Joy 94.9 has a huge range of programs available for podcast. In fact, Joy is one of the largest podcasting communities on community radio. If you haven't checked out our podcasting service, you're missing out. Visit joy.org.au, click on the podcast tab and you'll find a list of Joy programs regularly sharing the best interviews, news and reviews. There's tens of thousands of hours for you to enjoy, so check it out now, joy.org.au.
Our guest today, currently chef at Collins Quarter, has worked at the Fat Duck from Byron Bay, a lot of different food experiences.
Yeah, for sure.
We were just talking off air about the change in the business, how it's difficult to encourage young people up through the system because it's just financially very difficult to make money in a restaurant. If you can't make money, you can't pay staff, you can't buy ingredients and you can't pay the rent. The flip side of that is the food culture has changed so much. Celebrity chef TV shows, bloody blah, the accessibility of quality ingredients all around the world. And Stéphane was mentioning, being a French person, that you've got a take on French cuisine.
Well, I'm a bit biased because I have lived in Australia for nearly, 9 years now. I lived in England for 10 years. And so, yes, French originally. And I've been brought up in the hospitality industry because I lived with a family that was running a hotel restaurant. And I think food has evolved a lot in England, but it's still got this reputation of being not very nice. And I wanted to have your take on that because, to me, I think French food hasn't evolved. They do things very well in certain places, and regionally there's a lot of good things, but it hasn't evolved the same way as English food or, you know, restaurants in Britain have evolved. I just wanted to really ask you what you thought.
It's a really
about
fair
it.
Point. You know, the way I see kind of modern British food, I mean, it came, if you go back probably 15, 20 years, and I spent a little bit of time kind of looking into this because I was really curious about, obviously working in, you know, a lot of places over there, really curious about where some of the recipes came from and you know, whether it was Old English or whether it was something that had been adopted from either
like
a French...
Like butter
chicken. Yeah. Tikka masala, yeah. you know, whether it was something that had been adapted from another European country or elsewhere. So I did have a little bit of a look at it, and, you know, I think there's a number of factors that come into play when you look at modern British food. You know, I think people becoming a little bit more conscious about what they're eating played a big factor because, you know, you look at what you would commonly associate as an average British pub meal, it's all very stodgy. You know, it's all fried or pies or, you know, bangs mushy and mash, peas. Peas, fish and chips. So, you know, and it's all tastes delicious, don't get me wrong, but it's not very good for us. You know, it's not
not an athlete's menu.
Exactly. So I think, you know, to a certain extent, it came from people kind of being a little bit more mindful about what they ate. And also it's about a lot of influences coming in as well. You know, you have, you know, you look at the UK as a whole, you have influences from throughout Europe, Asia, you know, and even further, you know, people just going away for 2-3 years, even longer, moving back with their families, having different experiences, different food types. So, you know, that's all integrated into, and we're very fortunate in Australia, obviously we have that from the get-go, you know, because we're so multicultural.
There's only about 2% of us that can claim heritage here longer than 230-odd years.
Exactly, so. Right. So, but obviously UK being a lot older, they kind of have been stuck in their ways, but, you know, it sounds funny, and he cops a lot of flack, and probably deservedly so. But people like Jamie Oliver, you know, these sort of kind of, or those chefs around them, you know, really probably led a movement. You know, whether they were behind it
Nigella,
or not,
Jamie,
exactly. And you know, whether it was their ideas or that they were kind of the figure point for it. But that kind of simple cooking, 3 and 4 ingredients, use nice fruit and veg and fish and etc. It hit the market, you know, those early 2000s where people probably were ready for that change. Yeah. They were probably ready to eat better and didn't want to, you know, feel stodgy all the time. And what they did was make it so they could do it in 15 minutes, do it in half an hour. So people felt like they felt more comfortable with it. You know, so I think that was a big change. As far as restaurants, you know, it comes down to a lot of influence as well. And it comes down to kind of, I think, a lot of European influences. I think but a lot of different European influence, a lot of Scandinavian influences now throughout the UK, especially in London. I mean,
so what would you call a Scandinavian influence? Because that's not a region really known for its fine dining, although great restaurants, Noma and so forth.
It probably has become a bit more aware now, but I think through their ingredients, they're very clean eaters. So they, you know, probably the impact they've had is kind of allowing you know, the UK to use their heritage, but just use it, you know, a lot of pickling, curing, that sort of form of food, fermenting. Of cooking, fermenting, exactly. So, you know, it's allowed chefs to steer a little bit away, not to bag the French too much, but, you know, to steer a little bit away from, you know, your classic French fine dining. Yeah. And, you know, if you go back to that, you know, 80s, 90s in London, every fine dining restaurant was a French...
Cuisine, yeah.
French, yeah, exactly.
Which is basically just butter on everything.
Butter and cream.
Yeah. I come from Normandy, which is the...
Right, butter and cream.
Where they make butter and
bit of
cream.
A
and,
little bit of wine cheese. And you're there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's helped a lot, you know, like branching out a little bit further away from that and not being so stiff about, you know, fine dining, French, British cuisine, you know, trying to get a little bit more relaxed to it. Food becomes a little bit more accessible, you know.
Yeah, we had a British chef quite a while ago who was saying the funny thing about Britain is because it didn't have a great food culture, it really hung its hat on French food being its standard bearer. And as that trend sort of faded out from, you know, the 50s, 60s and 70s and looking into a more sort of outward-looking Britain, they were turning around and saying, well, we don't have a great food culture. We're not going to necessarily just hang our hat on what France does, although there's a long heritage connection to its next-door neighbour. But they turn around and say, well, we don't have to do that. We can do all these other things. We've got these amazing Indian influences and Caribbean influences, and you know, there's a huge connection to the United States, and different things happened after the war, and it evolved, and immigration changed literally the face of Britain.
And I feel it's relaxed a little as well. You know, you look at going back to, you know, 90s, fine dining was very, very rigid, very stiff, very expensive. I think it came a time where people was like, I still want to go out and have a good time. I still want to go and have dinner on a Friday night with some friends. And you couldn't always do that. You know, you go back to those days and it was probably five or six really good restaurants in London. There was always restaurants, but five or six really good ones doing great food. Now, 400, 500. Yeah. But that's only happened because of the desire that people want the change, you know. Sorry.
And then and pub food has changed a lot as well.
Yes.
From this, and I think, I don't know if it's from the TV show, from the evolution thing, but you can get really good food in sub pubs, not all of them.
Gastro pubs, there's
a big revolution at the gastro pub, you know, early 2000s, and it's still continuing on now, which is great because it brings back the hit. You know, you still have the classic favourites, you know, the UK that people always love, as we spoke about the fish and chips and the pork
really
pie.
Really well done fish and chips, steak and all that kind of.
But it's putting what we've learnt from fine dining and you know, higher-end cooking back into the pub system, you know, and you've had a lot of really good trained chefs that going back in and reevaluating the way we cook those items of food and just using great ingredients as well. If you think back, in pies were generally made out of old scraps and things, you know, old meats that you couldn't sell, that sort of thing, you know, that's going back some time. But now, in terms of premium quality ingredients going into all those dishes, and you see the level of, you know, of the food rising so much. And that's what's allowed that movement to keep going, is because people know they can go and have great food in a pub, still have a pint and really enjoy themselves and be relaxed while they do it, and also know what the food is, because, you know, everyone grows up with those staples.
Yeah. So then you came back to Australia.
Yes.
And you were mentioning, for circling back, that it's really hard to deliver a restaurant experience. It's really hard to get chefs together because there's not enough to attract people. So talk about that.
For me, it's the biggest problem facing our industry. You know, you can talk about ingredients, talk about, you know, costings of rent and et cetera, et cetera. It all falls away in comparison to the staffing situation that we face, because, yeah, we need to find a way to make it more attractive for young people to want to be in the industry. I don't exactly have all the answers for it, because it is complicated. Because, you know, you want people to earn a better wage, feel appreciated, work less hours. We all work too much as chefs, that's a fact.
What's an average week in hours?
I mean, it really varies from venue to venue. I put in a lot of hours. Obviously, I run a kitchen, so that's what I like. I'd like to be there. Mm-hmm. So I'm probably there, you know, between 50 and 60 hours a week. But, you know, I've tried to make a real conscious effort where I am now here at Collins to really make sure the guys still have some time off, make sure that, you know, getting a bit of rest, and because that benefits me as well. And that's something that obviously, going back to the fact that that's something they did really well is we did 4-day weeks. We had a bit of time off. Still did long hours while we were there, but really manage your staff. You know, it's the same if you're related to any sport. You know, you've got to manage your side. You know, if they're burnt out and exhausted, they're not going to cook for you.
They're going to leave.
Exactly. Yeah. They're going to leave.
Because the money's not great.
Exactly.
So if someone's going to give you better terms.
Exactly right.
It's a motivation, even though you might not be enjoying the kitchen experience, but just from an overall life balance. Does that mean that going back to someone like Byron Bay might be attractive because it's a, you're getting similar kind of pay and it's cheaper to live? Actually, Byron's not cheap, is it?
No, Byron's not overly cheap, that's true.
It's one of the things I learned in my research.
It's a tricky one with Byron. I mean, it's an amazing part of the world, and there's no doubt about that. To sustain a lot of fine dining restaurants, not quite sure it's there yet.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
We're on Joy 94.9. It is Escape Hour with Stefan and Marcus. Stefan's doing an amazing job behind the Wurlitzer here, getting us all on air. Good on you.
Thank you.
It's a lot to learn, and you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
It's currently 16 minutes to 2. You're on Escape Hour on Joy 94.9, and our guest, Luke Hedden, is runs the kitchen at Collins Quarter and has experience at some of the world's best restaurants. And he's originally from Byron Bay. Now, Byron Bay's not necessarily, I mean, you're not part of the LGBTI community, but Byron Bay's really a place for everyone. It's not a specifically gay place to go, but what are the key tourism things that you think of interest to young people in Byron Bay, apart from sitting around under some kind of meditation period stone off your head, doing a downward dog?
Yoga?
Yeah, unfortunately, there is that element to Byron. I mean, you can't escape that, but,
it's part of the appeal.
Exactly right. I mean, one thing kind
the
of touching...
The cult's like nut bars.
Kind of touching on that is Byron does have a special feel to it, and I think that's what has attracted, alternate-minded people, is that... Even when I go back there now, you drive through the town, you walk through the town, and it is a special place. There's a level of calmness to the place, unless you go there 3 days before Christmas, then it's a bit different. But it has got that lovely feel to it. There's loads to do. I mean, it's obviously a beautiful natural place. The beaches are gorgeous.
The weather's good.
Weather's good. Most of the year, pretty much all year round, it doesn't really get cold. I mean, my parents do make me laugh. They put a jumper on when it's 15 degrees, and that's cold. So, no, but Byron as a town is amazing. You have a good walk around. You literally walk straight onto the beach. You can sit and have a beer and overlook the water. Stunning.
Whale watching.
Exactly. Take a walk up to the lighthouse and have a look at the whales.
Yeah.
As a natural area, absolutely stunning. But just around Byron, there's loads of little places to go as well. You go 15 kilometres up the coast, you've got Brunswick Head. 15 kilometres south, you've got Lennox Head, which my parents are at now. And they're just beautiful little areas, lovely little villages, have lovely little cafes and restaurants and again, lovely beaches. So you've got that attached to it.
But Byron's not a cheap destination. It used to be.
It's not. Yeah, it did. I mean, I think naturally when you have a lovely part of the world and it starts to pick up, a little bit of credibility and people start to kind of want to go there every time they travel through, then naturally things are going to get more expensive because, where the demand's there, then people will charge.
Because you can't fly direct to Byron, I don't think. You have to go through Coolangatta, I think.
You can fly to Ballina. It's Ballina. Called Ballina Byron Gateway Airport, but it's still half an hour away.
Yeah. Yeah. So driving is popular, people doing the coast between Sydney and Brisbane, Sunshine Coast, that's a popular way that people are doing it. Backpackers spend a lot of time.
You get a lot of backpackers through. Yeah. They generally fly into Cairns and they'll do the
Eastern Seaboard.
Yeah, the van trip all the way down to Melbourne. So, there's naturally a lot of backpackers in there.
Passively aggressive painted vans.
Yes, exactly. Right.
Driving on the wrong side of the road.
Yeah, parked where they shouldn't be parked.
Yeah,
all that
exactly.
Sort of stuff. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, we've all experienced that. So, Byron obviously is a special place to you, but when you're in Melbourne, what do you think of when you think of Byron?
For me, when I think of Byron, it's just that relaxed atmosphere. And for me, one of the nicest times I like to go to Byron is almost during the winter months. It's got a level of calmness to it, a level of sleepiness to it. That's really nice. The weather's still, it can be unpredictable, but still, very nice. I really enjoy those times when I get to go up and visit and just really take a walk along the beach, relax, eat at a couple of nice cafes And that for me is the real nice experience of Byron. I still enjoy going there in summertime. Of course, anyone does because it's beautiful. But yeah, it does really have that peaceful feel to it. And for me, that's the biggest thing I get from it, is it kind of just getting relaxed, get away from everything for a bit, and just kind of reset and go again.
We have a very good question. This has come in from, It doesn't say who it was. Sorry, so I can't mention your name, but the SMS from 6454 are the last four numbers. Is it Budgie Smugglers, Boardies or Commando for the gay lads in Byron? Well, Byron, one of the things that came up in the research was the mayor of Byron Bay is struggling with a beat, and the mayor keeps saying, it's not a beat, just stop being naked and shagging on our beaches. So I think to answer your question from the Northern Star, there might be a bit of going around in the bath. Thanks for the question. So what's your take on this? Are people appropriately clad?
Depends on the time of year.
It seems like there are some pretty free spirits that traipse themselves around.
100%. You have a combination of free spirits and backpackers, and I think we can get the picture.
Okay. So Lismore and Nimbin probably have more of a gay community. I know that you're not from the LGBTI community, you can't speak to it directly, but I think that Lismore and Nimbin tend to have more of a residential queer community from the research that it has. And they're only short, 10-minute, 15-minute drives?
Probably around half an hour. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so that's where Lismore's Tropical Fruits, isn't it?
I'm not sure.
I think so. Yeah, maybe there's not. There's a rainbow band of rural living. It's kind of like Dale's Fiddish.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so there's plenty of places to stay, and there's affordable places to go. You can get buses to Byron. You can get there's share transport, which quite often goes, particularly with backpackers. And there's affordable homestay accommodation. So if you're interested in going and you don't have a huge amount of financial resources, or you don't want to spend the money, there are plenty of affordable ways to go and stay in queer-friendly accommodation. So just jump on your computer and have a look and Google gay homestays around the northern New South Wales coast region, around Nimbin, Lismore and Byron Bay. There's plenty of alternatives. You don't have to spend the big bucks. One of the things that's precluding a lot of people from travelling there is the costs have gone through the roof. So there's pretty good dining. There's very good accommodation. There's a lot of house sharing. But it's like southern New South Wales coast, like Mollymook. It's just not cheap.
No, that's right.
And I mean, it used to be cheap.
It did. I mean, yeah, that is a downside, obviously, having the tourist trade, it does. But, yeah, I mean, Byron's great in the sense that, you know, if you get a chance to even stay at the places you mentioned around, you can travel in. It's pretty good. There's buses that, run out to Nimbin on a daily basis, from Byron. So there is the option there to kind of stay a little bit further out and then come into the beach and have a wander around and then head out again. But
well, for our inquisitive listener, there is a clothing optional gay resort and camp area around Nimbin. I don't know the name of it. I've been trying to Google it, but the problem is when you start Googling things like this, you pretty much get leads to Pornhub. So, and there is so much. So I don't know the names of things, but Google away, entertain yourself as long as you're on your own. So would you go back and live in Byron Bay as a young person, or do you think that Melbourne is more of a place for a young person who's...
Oh, I mean, I'd love to go back and live in Byron, 100%. I mean, the only thing that kind of, for me, is obviously career in the hospitality industry. You know, I'd like to get, into, have my own fine dining sort of establishment one day. So Melbourne's very attractive to me for that manner. But as a lifestyle and what's available to you around Byron, it's a magnificent place to live. I mean, as you said, you've got the town itself, surrounding areas are beautiful. I mean, yeah, it's a really nice lifestyle to live up there. I thoroughly enjoyed being up there. So.
Yeah, what's the population of? I think it's about 250,000, isn't it, in the region?
Region?
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you, to be completely honest with you. But
that's a Google project.
Yeah. I don't want to speculate and then get it completely wrong, but it really fluctuates, Byron.
So, in the summer, it's really big population.
Exactly, it's one of those places where... As I mentioned earlier, like during the winter months, you can probably walk up the street at 10 in the morning and it's quite casual and calm and collected. If you try to do the same on a summer's morning, then you literally wouldn't get from one end of the street to the other in less than an hour. So it really fluctuates. which makes it hard for businesses, you know, to kind of keep going all year round.
So in terms of dining, would this population have had an impact on the dining scene and or cafe places? And
it really does. I mean, you have to make the money why the people are in town. It's the same as any seasonal place, I guess, to that extent. I think it may have held buying back a touch in having great places to go.
Yeah.
Just because of that, you know, no one likes to have that unpredictability in any sort of business. But obviously, because it is such an influx of people, if you can get involved in that while the people are around, then the opportunity is there. But it does quieten off a lot. So, you know, you have to really set yourself up well as a business to be able to survive those quieter months.
But a lot goes on in Byron Bay, and that's one of the things. They're known for big events like Splendor in the Grass. It's probably one of the reasons that most people would spend the money and go with a group. Splendor in the Grass is a big music festival. If you've never been, that's usually around late July. Byron Bay also is quite sporty. Next Saturday there's the Byron Bay Tri and Multisport Festival. So if you want to put your sporty spice pants on, there you go. But Byron does some things that I just absolutely love. On Saturday, 7th of July, under the moonless sky with the Milky Way high overhead, on the dark skies of Byron Bay, Australia's leading experts of space, cosmetology, and probably astronomy are going to have talks about looking up at the sky, so you can have your star read during the day, and then you can go and have an actual scientist talk to you about what the celestial bodies mean. And there's no rising Aquarius in that conversation, I can tell you. But there's a lot on in Byron Bay. Always check out the website.
So yeah, no, it looks like it, and we can get there flying to Ballina.
Ballina, yes,
So quite easy to. To go,
ByronBay.com is probably one of your best resources to go and see what's going on and plan what time of the year you're going to go and spend some time on the northern New South Wales coast. You're enjoying Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9, Australia's best radio station.
Russ is listening in. Russ is not here. He's a co-host and he's not well. Poor Russ, he's been to the doctor. He's a bit butcher's hook. Oh. Russ wants to know, do you fold or roll? And we're not talking about toilet paper. We're talking about when you travel.
I'm a roller.
You're a roller.
Mm.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm guilty. Mm. Yeah, definitely a roller.
Why? Why are you guilty? Are you ashamed of your rolling?
No, proud roller. I think you can fit more in rolling, personally.
Okay.
But,
I'm a bit of a shoe stuffer.
Yes.
Yeah, I do that.
Anything that needs to be washed in the shoe?
I fold. Yeah. And I did try both. And I found it...
You can't see Stefan's face. He's really working hard to get this out. He's perplexed. Am I a folder or am I a roller?
No, I am a folder.
You're a folder.
Actually, yeah.
You're a converted folder.
Converted. I've tried rolling and it didn't work for me.
Well, we've got a big lineup on Joy 94.9 all afternoon. Thank you for listening in. Luke, what's your final travel tip?
If you're going to Byron, try and get out and about, see the surrounding areas, have a nice walk along the beach, enjoy.
Relax.
Relax,
enjoy the weather, the food, the wine, the beach.
Exactly. Take it all in, have a, you know, reset a little bit and just enjoy it.
Well, thank you for joining us on Escape Hour on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.